Praise kick. Praise kick. Correct. The record chill. You cannot corrupt our spotless record. Praise kick. Oh yes, Trump will reduce Hillary to a nervous, shilling wreck. Praise kick. With the magic of memes, kick will break the seams. There's no limit to our meme power. Look to the fucking Trump Tower. Praise kick. Followers of kick, do not be hesitant.
Robert Stark. I am joined here with my two favorite Aussies, Luke Ford and Richard Wollstonecraft, and also Alex von Goldstein. Great having you all on.
Good day, mate.
Good day, mate.
Whereabouts are you, Luke? Are you in Melbourne or are you a city boy?
I'm from Sydney, but I live in Los Angeles.
Oh, you're over in Los Angeles. How is it over there? Has the big one
very
hit?
Good. Very good.
The big one hit yet? Has the big earthquake hit yet?
Any day.
Any day, I think, yes, Keck will be punishing California very soon, I believe, for, obviously voting for Hillary Clinton. So you can expect that.
Excellent.
Luke is praising Keck idolatry in your religion.
I guess it would depend how it's phrased. It's always ironic and a point of humor in all my associations with Keck, so that doesn't come up as a problem of idolatry in my world.
Richard, do you want to talk about the sort of theological significance of Keck?
Well, sure, let's do that. I think it's an interesting phenomenon. I might just mention, oddly enough, I just finished this film called The Second Coming, Volume 1 and Volume 2, which was based on the poetry of William Butler Yeats, kind of in general, but more specifically on the poem The Second Coming, which is a kind of apocalyptic poem that he wrote around 1919. And, a lot of the themes, oddly enough, I've just finished Volume 2 and I've just been working with the editor in between shooting my new film. And, there is definitely a kind of almost tech element to it, you know what I mean? Like, they're kind of like warring factions. I guess one you could call it the forces of light, or, you know, and there's another group within the film that are like the forces of darkness. So I think, you know, we could see that in relation to Keck, that, you know, Keck represents the forces of light, and you would say Hillary Clinton and Podesta and, spirit cooking and all that stuff, the forces of darkness. So here we have the two opposing sides, and obviously they went to battle last week, and Keck triumphed, with, of course, Mr. Donald Trump giving him a help along.
So what do you see as the difference between the occultism of the Podesta Amborovich spirit cookers and the Keckists?
Well, I have a sort of complex relationship with all this. I've always been fascinated by spirituality and theology, and I have quite a reasonable collection of books on the occult. I used to run a nightclub called the Hellfire Club, which was a famous S&M nightclub that operated in Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane. I think it still runs in Sydney and Brisbane every now and then, but I'm no longer involved in it. But I founded them all 25 years ago. And so I got interested in the occult. I studied it. I was never someone who practiced it, because I thought it was something that, if you don't really know what you're doing, it's something you shouldn't really mess with. But I definitely came to the conclusion from meeting some real occultists that it was actually real, in the sense that, like, black magic, for example, Aleister Crowley and all that kind of stuff, that it's definitely something real in relation to that. I met Kenneth Anger and a few other people who had practiced it, and I was definitely came over the impression that this is not just some, new age hippie kind of thing. This is something actually quite real. And then once I came to that conclusion, it kind of opened the door to, I guess, what you could call the traditional religions, the monotheistic religions. Christianity is the one that appeals to me the most. I've never been a huge student of Islam, though I studied it a little. And I guess Judaism will probably be put in the same boat. But I think, you know, in relation to Keck, that we are seeing a kind of a theological resurgence. It's almost Gnostic, you know what I mean? If I had to call it something, you know, which is a kind of, I guess it was a heresy in the early Christianity, the Gnostic religions. And obviously I'm a student of Carl Jung. So I've always been interested in Gnosticism, and when I see a lot of these people me-magicking away, I definitely feel as if here is a Gnostic community that's formed.
And I think what's interesting is it kind of started out as like a joke, and it kind of emerged into something greater.
I'm sure most things do start as a joke, and then get more serious, Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fascinating phenomenon. I mean, exactly how did it arise? Full genealogy of it, I'm not au fait with. So maybe someone could educate me in relation to that.
There's an interesting video by a Davis Orini about the origins of Keck. But it's funny is like he talks about these topics, but he's a guy who takes himself like very seriously. But then he says like Keck is like. He's like symbolizes chaos, but if we get too serious into Keck, Keck is going to destroy us, and like it gets really like dark, and it's an interesting video.
I mean, obviously I am someone who's very interested in spirituality, and I actually had a bit of a realization. I had a bit of a realization before the election that Hillary Clinton could be the Whore of Babylon from the Book of Revelations, and that did make me think. Well, then who's the Antichrist? Because the Whore of Babylon is tried by the Antichrist. I could make Trump the Antichrist. And I was kind of like, that's unusual. I mean, I hadn't considered that. And then I discovered that when Trump takes office, he will be 70 years old, 7 months and 7 days, which is, of course, the 777 from the Book of Revelation. So that's another interesting fact. But, in relation to the Whore of Babylon stuff, there was an interview with Hillary Clinton I read online where she said she was not human and that her father, she can't say who her father was, and that she was born in a basement somewhere. And I was like, it was in Vanity Fair or somewhere strange like that. I'll have to find it a reference and you can put it on the website later. But that instantly made me think of Jack Parsons. Are you familiar with the occultist Jack Parsons?
No, who's this?
He performed a ritual in 1946. Based on Crowley's writings, and it was a major ritual. It was called the Babylon Working. And essentially they were giving birth to a homunculus, which was a kind of a magical being, a moon child. And, of course, Hillary Clinton was born a year later. Maybe it's just a bunch of bullshit, but, it just, my occult kind of mind began to think along these lines, and it made me muse on all that. I mean, obviously it's just something to consider. But, might as well get it out there. I did notice one other person thinking along similar lines, Tracy Twynham, who's an occultist who's worked with Boyd Rice and others. So, it's something interesting. I don't know if it exactly relates to Keck, but I think it's an interesting anecdote. If Hillary the Whore of Babylon, prophesized. Probably not, but we'll wait and see.
Well, I saw Andy Nowicki, who is a Catholic, writing on the Alternative Right blogspot, saying that Donald Trump, in a way, is almost the opposite of the Antichrist. I mean, not that he's the second coming or something, but that he is showing providence, the idea of hope within Catholicism and the way that God works within mysterious ways and what can take us out of this sinfulness and degradation of our morals is the kind of broken man who says, grab her by the pussy and self-sacrifices himself to restore us to tradition. Who knows?
Exactly. And I don't think we should exclude Christianity from this conversation, because I think of all the religions I've studied and of all the occultism and just of everything I've studied that of a theological nature, including Buddhism and some other more esoteric Eastern religions, definitely Christianity is the one that most resonates with me. And the one that I think if I was to name a religion that comes closest to the truth, whatever that might be, because I believe in the transcendental unity of all religion to some extent. But I think Christianity definitely has some legs. You know.
And I know there was also, on the thing of the occult, you brought up that thing with WikiLeaks and John Podesta about, like, spirit cooking, like, where they were drinking, like, menstrual blood and semen, and that's like Alex Jones territory.
It was. I mean, you know, and this is the kind of thing that, you know, you read about, and, you know, I mean, it's an anti-Semitic canard that, you know, someone like John Podesta, a kind of, like, powerful Jewish person, is drinking blood with Satanists. I mean, this is like a, you know, it's like an anti-Semitic, like, you know, joke almost. But there it was in black and white. Obviously, it was a kind of ritual, it was kind of an artsy-fartsy thing, so it probably wasn't exactly, you know, like meeting in the dark of night and then murdering somebody. But, like, you know, like, I don't know who the hell does that, but, like, I don't know, maybe, like, people surrounding the Manson family might have done something like that. The Process Church of the Final Judgment, that unusual church, Adam Parfrey released a book on. I mean, you know, the whole WikiLeaks thing in relation to Podesta and all that spirit cooking stuff, I mean, on some levels it seems innocuous, you know what I mean? But then, you know, when you mix it together with, say, some of the meta ideas of, say, someone like David Icke, I don't know, I mean, it begins to resonate and have a kind of more evil overtone to it.
I wanted to ask you, Luke, why do you think rich sort of cosmopolitan Jews like John Podesta get involved in things that, you know, like this Ambrovich sort of, you know, occultism? Yeah. Like, why do, like, cosmopolitan Jews, desire this sort of stuff?
Well, if you're not practicing traditional Judaism, you're going to seek out some sort of spiritual or transcendent release. So, you know, Jews are disproportionately involved in all kinds of, you know, crazy activities, but these are Jews outside of Orthodox Judaism. As an Orthodox Jew, I have absolutely nothing to do with occultism or anything related. I have no interest. I flee from these topics. I don't think about them. I don't read about them. I don't wonder about them. To me, they're just, yuck, they're unclean, and I keep them out of my life. And don't speculate on them. None of the Jews that I'm friendly with are involved or have ever been involved in this sort of thing. But I did know Jews in the porn industry who would, you know, dabble in Satanism, and a lot of Gentiles as well in the porn industry who would dabble in Satanism. But it's something that's completely repulsive to me.
Oh, I do agree that, I mean, I have known some people who've been interested in the occult part of things, and I mean, I'm still friendly with some of them, so I can't say that. My observation is that it is dangerous, and obviously, I did feel some kind of revulsion towards thinking what would be considered black magic or Satanist kind of elements of that scene. And, you know, I was running a club called the Hellfire Club, so, you know, if I ever get to the Pearly Gates, it's going to be fun to explain, isn't it? And, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's just, you know, it's fascinating, but yeah, I do think it is dangerous in some ways. Some people would say the alt-right itself is dangerous. So, you know,
well, that's an interesting idea. I mean, there are people who view the alt-right as essentially evil and tied to hate. And that's, I mean, people who are on the outside of sort of white identity politics and who can't wrap their head around it. I think they may be afraid of their own identity, and they reject their own white identity because they fear the kind of person they would be if they embraced themselves.
I think that I'm a real student of Carl Jung. I've actually attended some courses at school in Zurich, and I studied him at university, and I think studying this kind of material, though you might have a revulsion to it, sir, but like I think it can be helpful in the sense that it's called shadow work within Jungian psychoanalysis. It's where you know, basically what's wrong with the world is essentially in us all. You know what I mean? Like we all have a kind of evil within us, and to actually be able to study it through a certain kind of creative, whether it be what's called shadow work. I mean, this can be done with psychoanalysis. It can be done creatively. Obviously, I channel this kind of energy off into my films. I've made films about dark topics, and this new one, The Second Coming, obviously is musing on occultism, so I've kind of channeled that into this film a little bit. But I think that is a good place to express this kind of material and not within your own life. And, that, you know, I mean, I had a few weird things happen to me in the 90s. I nearly died. I had a liver abscess that came out of nowhere and nearly killed me around the kind of very unusual time when I was 27. So, I didn't know where that came from. Obviously, I thought, did it have something to do with all this occultism that I was at least connected to back then? But, you know, I think it is something that is, yeah, I do agree it's potentially dangerous and that I can understand people being repulsed by it.
Do you think a lot of these people who get into, like, occultism and Satanism, like a lot of these like kind of like Hollywood types, do you think a lot of it is just kind of like a dilettantism?
No, I don't know. I mean, I remember, you know, I mean, my road to religion or theology, I guess, I mean, obviously when you're a kid, you're told about religion. My parents weren't particularly religious, but they were Church of England and they just basically sort of believed in God. And I obviously rebelled against that as a teenager. I read Nietzsche when I was like 14 or 15. Obviously he fucked me up. And, so then you kind of have that kind of Nietzschean atheist thing. And I guess when I started the Hellfire Club, I was doing it. It was almost like a punk act. It was kind of like rebellious, you know. I mean, you know, and there's no greater rebellion than linking yourself to some kind of something that's vaguely satanic or whatever. So, you know, but I wasn't doing it out of a belief that I was a Satanist. I was doing it because I was being a cheeky 22-year-old when I started that club. And but, yeah, I mean, as I said, as I got further into it, and when I was running a club called the Hellfire Club, that was actually a club that has existed throughout history, dating back to the 18th century in England, where it was founded by Sir Francis Dashwood. You know, I think it did have some maybe bad energy, and that basically I've gotten out of doing that. I stopped doing that in the early 00s, and I went back to university and I studied philosophy, and I just really got that whole thing out of my life. So,
well, it's interesting because both Richard and Luke had been involved in sort of sexual, like you know, Luke wrote about porn. Richard,
tell us about your porn days, Luke. Tell us a little bit about your porn.
Well, is this an Australian thing? I mean, do you guys have more testosterone than European?
They breed us. They breed us. You know, frisky down here.
Do you agree with that, Luke?
I'm not sure. I think. Yeah, there might be like a rebellious undertone to being Australian, but I think pornography has played probably a bigger role and is more accepted in the United States of America than in Australia, though. It's complicated in that you have more legalized brothels in Australia than you have in America. But I was interested in deviant sexuality and I was interested in the pornography industry. And I got to tell you, within a few months of starting to research those topics, I was pretty much sick of them. And I did stay in for another 12 years writing about them because that's how I made a living. But I was briefly curious for a few months, and then I had, you know, more than my fill. In fact, you know, I reacted, you know, completely against that. So going into my research, I was quite sexually promiscuous. And once I was a few months in, I just could not behave that way anymore.
Yeah,
really pulled back on that kind of behavior.
I saw.
Did your exposure to that play a major role in you becoming religious?
No, because I've been religious pretty much all my life, except for a few years in college. But it did help me to see some of the benefits of religion in a more visceral way. When I saw the people who lacked religion often would reach for the spiritual and the transcendent in really weird and possibly destructive ways, such as Satanism, I just saw that most people can't live without some sort of spirituality, transcendence in their life. And for many people, if they've had a good experience, a solid experience of religion, and then left it, at least they are cured for life of needing to delve into that realm. But if people have grown up without belonging to a traditional religion, then they're much more vulnerable to pursuing some of this crazy spirit cooking stuff.
Well, yeah, I saw someone on the internet saying that the only reason why young white men rebel against multiculturalism is because they are sexually frustrated. And I think that you know, maybe there's some kind of truth in that, that sexual frustration can lead one to sort of question society. But at the same time, like, I'm someone who has, you know, gone through periods of sexual frustration and then gone through periods where I was having sex more often with random women, and it's not fulfilling, you know? Like, I remember someone said they were researching porn and they were all excited that their job was going to be watching porn all day. And after a while, you just see these two pieces of meat hitting each other, and it's, you know, when there's nothing there. It becomes, you know, sex for sex is just a violent act of nothingness.
There's something soul-destroying about pornography. I mean, I made a documentary on it recently called The Last Days of Joe Blow, which was about a porn star, Michael Tim, stage name is Joe Blow. And, you know, I thought that was a very interesting kind of experience. I went to Los Angeles and we shot there a lot, and it was a fascinating learning curve. When I set out to make the film, I basically wanted to make a film that was pro-pornography, at least in the sense of, like, you know, it wasn't going to be kind of moral tut-putting. It was going to be an exploration of that world. But the more I got, involved in looking at it, and the more I hung out with Michael Tierney in Los Angeles, who was basically leaving the porn business around the time that I was beginning to film with him, and he basically did leave. The documentary, took a couple of years to film, and he basically did leave, and then he basically had a nervous breakdown, and he got interested in the cult, and, I mean, it was... It's all documented in the film, so you can get it online from Monster Pictures. But, like, it's a fascinating area. But my observation of it is that getting involved in pornography, like when you're acting in it, there's something about monetizing one's intimacy or one's intimacy that is involved in one's sexual acts that is, dark or destructive.
I know people who have been involved in porn. And a lot of the times they're women who have had, you know, 70 plus sexual partners and just sort of spent summers of their lives having sex with different men every day. And it's, you know, there's this sort of like being involved in pornography as an empower, you know, it's, this is a self-empowering thing that, you know, women see, but then they get pushed further into it, and they realize that they're in self-deception, and they move into doing drugs like heroin, and it's a real downward spiral.
Yeah, there's this crazy notion in the pickup game that you should leave women better than you found them, but let's be honest, no woman is improved by the injection of your penis. Like, every cock that a woman absorbs, it takes, you know, it really, you know, it does some damage. So that, you know, once a woman's had, you know, more than half dozen lovers, you know, when she's ridden the cock carousel, she is, you know, permanently warped, damaged, and is a very poor choice for a potential mate, for a potential wife, and as a potential mother of your children. So,
I mean, you're talking about, like, sexual frustration in relation to the alt-right and stuff, but, I mean, my experience would probably be the exact opposite of that, because in my 20s, I started this club, the Hellfire Club, and as I said, I was running it in Melbourne and Sydney, and, you know, occasionally in Brisbane and a couple other places in Australia. Essentially, it was like being a rock star. I mean, I was making quite a bit of money, and all the women at the club just wanted to sleep with me, and they wanted to do S&M with me. And, like, it was – I mean, obviously, it did, you know, wear thin after, say, 3 or 4 years of it. But, like, I mean, I must have slept with over 200 women just in the 90s alone. And
none of them were the better for it. They were all damaged by it, and they were all that worse off.
By me, they weren't damaged by me.
Were all damaged by you, and they were all damaged by me. No woman is better off for having another cock.
Have you seen married. That meme, the thousand cock stare?
Yeah, exactly. That's the point. It warps them. You can see it in the eyes.
It might warp some of them, sure, but, like, I would not make that blanket moral judgment.
Well, we can look at it statistically, and the number one predictor of whether a marriage will last or not is the number of sexual partners that the woman has had prior to the marriage. Not the number of partners that a man has had, the number of partners that a woman has had. A woman who's had more than half a dozen partners is a really bad bet to be your wife.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to marry a porn star, am I? But I just think that, I think that if men can whore around, I think women can. But obviously it does have a different effect upon women, and I think men can get away with it. But also, too, I mean, I've gotten a bit older now. Now I'm in my mid-40s, and I definitely am nowhere near as nowhere near as big a slut as I used to be, which is a good thing, because I got that, you know, I sowed my seeds and all that stuff, and I've basically been in a monogamous relationship most of the time in the last 15 years. It's a bit on again, off again, but, like, you know, it's been great. So, you know, look, I would say that my leaning now is towards more traditional arrangements. I've never been married, but I would consider myself probably a nominal Christian, particularly after watching this film, The Second Coming, which is just full of religious imagery and, you know, kind of like, you know, the forces of light and dark, almost the book of Revelation to it.
Well, yeah, I was reading this book by Andy Nowicki, just bring him up again because he's a Catholic writer who I like reading.
He's a fascinating figure with it.
Yeah. Oh, is this the one, Confessions of a Would-Be Wanker?
Yeah. And he talks...
Most of his books, I've actually read it when I interviewed him. Like, most of his books are fiction. I personally prefer his fiction work, and they deal with the same themes, but, like, it's a manifesto about the effects of sexuality, but yeah, that's the main themes of his work. And a lot of his different books, like,
yeah, but there's a,
I'd recommend,
yeah,
checking out like a Heart Killer and Columbine Pilgrim. I've read that one you mentioned.
I will definitely check out his fiction writing, but I do enjoy reading his writing on Catholicism. And something about Would-Be Wanker that affected me is that he talks about sexuality as a corruptive act and sort of the time in your life before you're engaged with sexuality. You view it as something that's bad. And you see the kids around you, they start to curse, they start to smoke cigarettes, they start to, you know, finger girls and stuff like that, and maybe one of them gets a blowjob and so on and so on and so on. But that time is sort of a corruptive time. And in the world that we live in, this world of increased sexual freedom, it's almost like if one does not engage in the corruption, that they are defective, and that the corruption is the thing that leads you to freedom. But
saying that both people who are overly sexualized or not sexualized, you're saying they're both corrupted?
No, I'm saying people that are not sexualized are actually uncorrupted, and people that are sexualized are essentially corrupted. I mean, there is something I think a little bit wrong about denying your sexuality altogether. But I do think that putting too much importance...
I have a much probably more complex relationship to all that kind of stuff. I've never viewed sex as evil. I've never agreed with a lot of the religious and theological attitudes towards sexuality. Obviously, I studied someone like Wilhelm Reich that sees sexuality as basically a kind of energy, like a kind of organ energy and a positive thing. So I guess I'd probably be a Reichian to some extent. My own interest in sexuality, I guess I'm a straight guy, basically, but I have an interest in S&M or sadomasochism, obviously, from the Hellfire Club. That was that kind of club, but I have no idea where that came from, but it's just something that, you know, I've just always been interested in, probably from when I was quite young, which is really quite unusual, I guess. But I remember as a teenager, when I used to go into pawn shops and buy, you know, a magazine like Janus magazine, which is like an English spanking magazine or something like that, and then I collected about 10 of them, and I hid them away in my room somewhere.
I mean, the thing about, you know, I think that there can be some sort of pornography that can be tasteful. I remember there was a magazine a couple of years ago called Jacques Magazine that sort of had, well-photographed images of women, and it was interesting. But I still think that I'm not sure if masturbation is a bad thing or not, because I just hear that, you know, it can really just fuck up your dopamine levels in your head. And Luke, I think you might know about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I've been free of masturbation for 4.5 years as a self-identifying sex and love addict. I had to completely cut it out of my life to, you know, go through the world sober. I'm sorry?
How do you do that? That'd be a good question.
How do I stop? Well, I stop, and I'm part of a 12-step program that addresses sex addiction and love addiction and codependent relationships and kind of the dark and addictive side of romance and sex. And I've been a part of that program for about 6 years, and it's dramatically improved my life.
So
Luke, do you want to move on to the election?
Please.
Yeah, I think you're kind of getting tired. You've kind of burned out of this topic.
Exactly.
So you have this article, When Did I Board the Trump Express? And this is a collection of posts you did about your thoughts on Trump, and you were skeptical of him at first.
Yeah, like I've been in the United States of America since 1977. I remember first hearing about Donald Trump, you know, I have distinct memories, say, back to 1985. And I really didn't have any opinion on Donald Trump or any interest in Donald Trump until July of 2015. So it was on June 16 of 2015 when Donald Trump announced he was running for president. And that morning, a friend came up to me and said, Donald Trump is running on all the things that you're always talking about, because I've been associated with white nationalism since 1999. And so I've written about these themes on and off for, you know, almost 20 years. And my friend came up to me and he was all excited and in praise of Donald Trump's candidacy. And I just immediately dismissed it because I thought of Trump as a blowhard, as a New York real estate developer and reality TV show. I had no interest in Donald Trump. And then my friend started making jokes about Donald Trump via email. I have several close friends that emailed me about Trump. And for two weeks, I didn't pay any attention. And then I started posting on July 4th that Donald Trump is kind of interesting to watch. The outrage over his comments in particular is interesting because no one's actually trying to refute his facts. They're just using slurs to put him down. And on July 4th, I made my first post on Facebook, kind of acknowledging what Trump was doing, saying that until Trump came along, all the other candidates were avoiding the issue of immigration, including, Scott Walker. And so I started a Donald Trump category on my blog, started to take him seriously in early July of 2015. And I noticed over the next few weeks that he kept tapping into these ethno-nationalist sentiments, these white nationalist sentiments, and, really Trump's more of a civic nationalist than an ethno-nationalist, but there's some interplay. And then I noticed that Kevin McDonald was taking Donald Trump seriously, and the commenters on Steve Saylor's website were taking Trump seriously. And so I take both Steve Saylor and Kevin McDonald very seriously. And so then I started paying more attention. And finally, in August, I saw my first Trump rally, on YouTube, the rally on August 21st in Mobile, Alabama. And I got the chills. I got the chills watching what was going on. And this was something like way before, the cognitive level. This was just like an animalistic reaction. I got the chills that there was a genuine, something going on, that America had a Caesar. And from August 21st onward, I would tell anybody who would wanted to know my opinion that I thought Donald Trump was going to be the next president of the United States. So from August 21, 2015, I've been firmly aboard the Trump Express and just constantly writing about Trump and exploring the ideas that make him such a compelling candidate.
It's interesting you said you knew he was going to be president. A lot of people, including his supporters, were very skeptical and pessimistic about his chances of winning.
Oh, I knew from August, like Luke did. I just saw, as soon as the refugee crisis or the migrant crisis really kicked into high gear, I knew that there would be a white reaction, like a growth of white racial consciousness. I saw the Black Lives Matter protesting. I saw Caitlyn Jenner being named Woman of the Year, and I saw the migrant crisis. And I'm like, well, white people are just gonna react to this, and yeah. they have.
It's like the frog in the boiling theory, or like the Pepe in the boiling pot.
Okay, explain.
If you'd like me to talk about how I came to Trump.
Sure, let's hear it.
Okay, I think I was aware that when he first announced he would run, but I didn't even think he might win the Republican nomination first. But I think I was in Bali with Scarlett Johansson's brother and Gus Till, who's a musician friend of mine who lives there. And I don't know, we were hanging out, we're talking about politics, and my friend Gus is a left winger, but he was quite sympathetic to Trump. And we began to talk about it, and I began to this. Obviously, I was on a holiday, so I had a bit of spare time, and I was just reading a lot about him online. And I did what you said. I watched some speeches that he was doing. And my friend Jim Van Bever, someone from the film community, who's an independent filmmaker from America, he was a very early Trump man, probably a year ago. And
what kind of films does he make?
He dropped really, and I just thought this guy's the man. And I wrote this essay called "The Metapolitics of Winning," where I spoke about kind of mythical elements and the kind of basically that the metapolitics of winning, that he has this kind of winning attitude to things that is not just like his rhetoric, that's got some kind of other deeper level to it. And and then I think that essay essentially came true.
yeah, I think most of your writing on Trump has kind of proved itself. I remember listening to Rush Limbaugh, and he was saying, someone I'm not really a fan of, but I do like to listen to what he has to say every now and then, just because I think he has a lot of influence, and we should listen to people who are influencing other people. And and Rush Limbaugh said, his Trump supporters know what he's doing. They're in on the joke. And as soon as I started to be able to get in on the joke, I started to understand the art of the deal and like the metapolitics of winning, like you're saying, and it kind of made more sense. It's like, oh, okay, now I'm on that side of the friend-enemy dialectic.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that it really struck me, and I sensed that he was something quite powerful. I think there's a number of events that are quite historical, really. I mean, with Brexit. With this immigration crisis into Europe, that if any one of these events, potentially didn't happen, obviously Julian Assange with WikiLeaks, if any of these didn't happen, I mean, Trump may not have got over the line. So it's almost been a perfect storm for him.
And, yes, that's what we've been calling
like
he's had
it. Someone on his side, if we get back to theology, maybe he has God on his side.
Yeah.
Or something. Maybe it's Keck and Pepe. But there's definitely something mythical about what Donald Trump is doing. And obviously there's been the usual scare campaigns about him, like Brexit. Oh, the economy's going to collapse. Oh, it's terrible. He's never done anything. But, I mean, the Dow Jones, I think, posted its highest number just like yesterday or something. And it's quite extraordinary, I think. And I think I'll quite happily predict it here. There's going to be a Trump boom that will be basically like the 1980s. It will be an incredible time for the American economy. Obviously, if you're a capitalist, obviously, maybe if you have a different interpretation of the economic situation, you might not like that. But I can definitely see a Trump boom coming.
Luke posted this article, The Way Forward, by the commentator Chaim Amalek. And Chaim Amalek has some interesting points on here that Trump should do things like reestablish Glass-Steagall, break up big media conglomerates, some degree of socialism.
His 28-point plan, did you see that? It was kind of floating around the internet yesterday, I think. And I think there's a lot of good points there. I mean, basically, he's not even president.
I know about the 28-point plan, but I was referring to something Luke posted by Chaim Amalek, but Trump touches upon some of those issues in that as well.
Yeah. Trump's about American greatness. Like, his starting point is not economic freedom, like traditional conservative Republican capitalists. His starting point is a particular people and what's good for a people. And I think race is number one. Like, once you figure out race, then you can then go on to deal with other issues such as the economy, such as public transportation, such as housing, such as educational standards. But until you deal with race, then every other approach, is simply inadequate. So I think the racial question comes first. And even though Trump isn't explicit, but he's implicit.
I agree.
That's an interesting point because, a lot of people might have issues with some of Trump's positions. Like, Trump has had some very anti-environmental stances. But if you look at a place like Southern California, the environment has been wrecked for all this mass immigration.
Well, yeah, yes. I mean,
go ahead, Richard.
If people are serious about being green, the first thing they should do is obviously limit immigration. I mean, people are the cause of everything. Essentially, you should be, especially be an anti-humanist. Obviously, David Attenborough is a famous environmentalist and documentary maker who is world famous, probably one of the most famous people in British broadcasting. He is an extreme anti-humanist. He sees the basic problem is humanity, and it really is. It's not the wealthy 1%. All respect to George Soros, it's not actually George Soros that's polluting the planet. It's just the masses of people that breed in the third world, and obviously many of them are now trying to move into the West, and it's this vast, it's like a tsunami of human beings.
The camp of the saints.
It definitely dates back to Thomas Malthus, who was a famous English bishop, who predicted that basically the human race would reach a stage where it would destroy its environment and, basically human life would become untenable. Obviously, it's taken 200 years because he did write at the beginning of the 19th century. But, I think Sir Thomas Malthus is going to have his revenge.
What do you think on the whole topic of overpopulation? I know a lot of people in the alt-right, they want to see a white baby boom. Do you see that as a good thing to promote pronatalist policies, or do you see overpopulation as more of the issue?
Yeah, well, I start with the issue of race. So I want Jews to be numerous, particularly in the Jewish state. I want the Jewish state to be strong. And also as someone who identifies also as white, I want whites to be strong and I want their nations to be strong. And that means having lots of children. One of the things that I love about being an Orthodox Jew is that when I go to an Orthodox Jewish synagogue, it is overflowing with children. When I go to a Reform and Conservative synagogue, it's filled with old people and often there are very few children. So, having lots of children for white people, for Jews is something that's particularly on my mind. Now, I don't use the terms good and evil, except for when I'm talking with people who share my faith statements. Outside of subjective, faith, there is no good and evil or objective morality in the world. There are no good guys or bad guys. I don't think that, whites are the good guys and non-whites and Asians or blacks or Latinos are the bad guys. We're all just different forms of life struggling for survival, in competition for scarce resources. So, for some forms of life, Hillary Clinton would have been a better selection for their interests. For other forms of life, Donald Trump was a better selection for their form of life to perpetuate itself. So I see us, all in a constant Darwinian struggle.
Some alt-right blogger predict a white baby boom because he says women have sex dreams of Trump?
Well, let me put it. That's Matt Forney, and we said that there would be a baby boom because Pepe was a fertility figure.
I also think because that could be one factor could be if people are more optimistic about the future.
Well, they have more money. The reason why people don't have, the reason why white people don't have children is because they don't have stability. I think white people are people who think in terms of they have a low time preference where they plan for the future. So I don't have a lot of money for me to have a child right now. I don't know if that would be a smart investment for me financially. There's people that don't share, my identity or racial background or whatever, that doesn't really matter that much to them. It's sort of, they have children without having the financial backings.
White self-confidence is at its lowest point in Western history. Whites have never been more beaten down, particularly in the United States, than they are today until this election. So they have more confidence in the future, then they will make more investments in both the business and in, making children and creating families. When you're beaten down and feeling pessimistic about the future, you're much less likely to invest in it.
Luke, how do we deal with self-hating white people?
go ahead, Alex. Richard, you've had a good say. Alex, what was your question?
I was just going to say, how do we deal with self-hating white people?
Well, you have to purge. You have to act so that this is not acceptable. You know, no society can permit completely, you know, free expression. Like, any society that's going to perpetuate itself must have things that are sacred. And, you know, the best organizing principle for a country is ethno-nationalism. And so the good and the holy of your own people must be the top priority for any healthy nation.
Well, how do you combat people who say that, oh, that's just an archaic idea, and we're all molding into one, and look at all these people that have blended families and all this kind of stuff. That's the argument that they'll bring up to you. How do you?
Well, you have to throw your support behind those who are racially healthy, and you have to view those who are, you know, not racially healthy as the enemy. So, as Carl Schmitt put it, the friend-enemy distinction is the fundamental basis for all politics. Well, and so you support your friends and you rain hellfire on your enemies when necessary.
I mean, hang on a second. May I interject there? I'm probably not from the white nationalist element of the alt-right. I would consider myself somebody who more values Western civilization. And it's
I'm not a white nationalist either.
So you, Alex?
I'm not a white nationalist either. And I don't think Robert is... as well.
I mean, obviously, I have an interest in that. I think that I see, I mean, obviously, different ethnic groups throughout the world. I mean, the Jews are obviously one, but like, I mean, there's never a problem with people within the African American community talking about their community and their interests. The Asian community, the Muslim community, the Jewish community. I mean, this is all, it's all kosher, you know, to pardon the pun, but obviously the one group of people that can't really talk about that, at least within mainstream media, are basically white Europeans, and I think that is terrible, and that is ridiculous.
We have a
right to behave that way, and not only that, everything we see is the product of the European mind. Technology, science, and if you include Jewish people, which I do, within white identity or European identity, basically everything is the product of the European
mind.
Well,
there is a book,
If we are to throw this out, or really, to me, less is more in everything. Basically, we need less people, like altogether. We need an economy that is not based around growth. This planet is a beautiful planet, but this is far too many people. I would say about 80% of people on this planet are unnecessary, and that's quite a misanthropic thing to say, and I don't suggest, you know, some kind of hideous act that will wipe out 5 billion people, but that is actually the truth of the situation. At least 80% of people on this planet are utterly pointless.
Well, the thing about your European accomplishments, I mean, Charles Murray has a book that's, I think it's just called Human Accomplishments. And he lists out like what people have done what. And most accomplishments have been made by, you know, like Anglo-Saxons and Germans. And then, you know, you have other groups of Europeans, and then, you know, you have Jews and Asians and other groups participating. But I mean, it's obvious when you look at this chart, sort of who is, contributing to human progress, and
all the major writers, all the major filmmakers, all the major philosophers.
But just in science as well.
In the world is of a European mind. Now, it's not to say that there are not valuable things from Japan or from some Asian countries, and even from the Muslim world at times. But like, I think viewed globally, the contribution of Western civilization to basically the whole human species has been tremendous and beyond parallel and I think European people have evolved. We've continued to evolve, and that we are now in a space that we've moved in the last, aided by technology and what Martin Heidegger called the technological scientific world picture. We are now we are so far advanced to say what the Muslim world, for example, which is still stuck within medieval times, its mindset. We are light years ahead of these people now. And that, I don't know, I mean, it's like we live in different worlds. And if you understand...
Yeah, we're in a... Yeah.
I think we are living in different
worlds. We're in a different universe. I was talking to a friend of mine last night about this sort of stuff, and she told me that our detractors can't understand what an alternate reality is, that we really do, we respond to things differently. When we see a media story, we have our response to it. It's different from their response. I mean, I was watching Bill Maher at a friend's house, and they were trying to talk
about... Oh, the recent post-election one.
Well, yeah, for 2 seconds. But they were trying to talk about... they were trying to talk about the white working class. And when I saw these people try to talk about whites, these whites, when they try to talk about whites, they can't do it without feeling some kind of shame. They can't talk about their own racial identity without feeling you see they're not speaking with confidence. I think it's very difficult for white people to speak about being white and not feel shame. At least,
and I think that's ridiculous. I mean, if any people on the planet have a reason to be proud, it's us. So I think it is absurd, and I'm not exactly sure where it comes from. Let's lay the blame at the door of the evil globalists. And you know, I think it's some kind of agenda that's developed since World War II. Obviously, there was a window for a different kind of world. Obviously, within the National Socialist and the Fascist experiment in Italy, and basically, yeah, I mean, that world was essentially closed down. There were many people that believed in it, who are obviously intellectuals like Carl Schmitt, Ernst Jünger, Martin Heidegger, people like this, who at least were fellow travellers for a while, that saw something different in it, I think. And in a way, we're seeing a return of at least, I mean, hopefully not the destructive element of
yeah, that's the problem. That's the problem.
A trend, like we were talking about, being the theme of being beaten down and pessimistic about the future. Like, I've been reading all these bloggers, people you mentioned, like Steve Saylor, Pat Buchanan, for years now, and there's always been this strong pessimistic current of like doom and gloom. And this is like the first time where I'm sensing a strong feeling of like hope and optimism.
Yeah, well, John Derbyshire just did a on his radio Derb. The importance of gloating and how we deserve to start gloating now. And, you know, I feel like I'm becoming more like Luke Ford, actually, where Luke is someone who says what's on, you know, because Luke talks about Jewish issues in a very open way. And that's something that a lot of people don't really like talking about. But also you are an Orthodox Jew. But,
How did you come to Judaism? May I ask that? I mean, you
obviously. I was very sick when I was at UCLA, and I was like struggling for meaning and structure and purpose to my life. And I encountered a very kind talk radio host named Dennis Prager, who was also a very eloquent exponent of Judaism. And I became fascinated by Judaism and by the Jews that I got to meet and know at UCLA. And I just couldn't stop reading about it. And just, you know, that was my all-consuming passion for at least a decade.
Well, I think that's fascinating. Obviously, I've had a partial interest in Judaism. Obviously, I studied the Old Testament. I think there's a lot of power to these writings. And
well, what do you think about people who say that Judaism is not necessarily a religion? I mean, there's the whole Kevin MacDonald idea that it is just like a group evolutionary strategy.
Right, but I haven't read anything by Kevin MacDonald, you know, in a major point that he's ever made that I would disagree with. Like, I think Kevin MacDonald is a towering genius. Judaism is the name that we give to the religion of the Jews, because, you know, in the Western world we have religions, but really Jews are a people. And Judaism is, you know, the religious name that's given to that. But the more religious the Jew, the less he talks about Judaism. There's just, you know, Yiddishkeit, which is just like the Jewish way of doing things. So it's not a religion like Christianity is a religion. It's a people. And because we're in a Western world where they separate, you know, religion from the nation and from politics, you know, we have to call the religion of the Jews, you know, Judaism. But the more you know, involved and immersed you are in being Jewish, you know, the less you think in terms of Judaism and the less you use that language, you're a part of a people first and foremost.
Luke, you posted this tweet by Peter Beinart, and he posted after Trump got elected, this is the first time in my life I felt more Jewish than American. What are your general thoughts on Jewish attitudes towards Trump, both Orthodox attitudes and more kind of establishment Jewish attitudes towards Donald Trump?
Well, according to the exit polls, it seems that Donald Trump got no more than about 20% of the Jewish vote, which surprised me.
Is that less than Romney?
Yeah, that's much less than Romney. But it's about the same as George W. Bush and Herbert Walker Bush. So it's not like an all-time low. But most American Jews come from Eastern Europe, where they lived for hundreds of years in a state of enmity with the non-Jews around them. So most Jews instinctively side with the coalition of the fringe. So you'll find many Jewish names on any movement that seeks to maximize minority rights, and you will find very, very few Jewish names on any movement that seeks to maximize the rights of the majority in the Western world. So Jews instinctively side with other minorities against the white Christian majority. So Peter Barnard's response is pretty representative of Jews, particularly Jews of Eastern European origins, who, you know, tend to have much more of a chip on their shoulder against the goyim.
What are your thoughts on people like Paul Gottfried and Mickey Kaus?
I think Paul Gottfried's an absolute giant. I think he's an incredible thinker. He's a giant. He's of German Jewish origins. So German Jews and Jews of Western European origins don't have that same chip on their shoulder against the goyim that Jews of Eastern European origins tend to have. Mickey Kaus also seems like a very Westernized Jew, you know, a Jew who does not have that chip on his shoulder against the goyim.
I read on his Wikipedia page his family was from Austria.
Yeah, and he's a very, very smart man, and you know, definitely one of the 10 most important political commentators of the past 20-25 years.
Yeah, I mean, in relation to the whole the Jewish question, I mean, I guess that's come up here a little bit. I mean, look, you know, the situation to be obviously when you look at something like the globalist, you have to admit that, you know, at least within the American media, for example, I mean, certainly Jewish people are definitely globalists, and obviously Soros is, even though he's anti-Israel. I mean, but I do think, you know, when you say something like the Jews or whatever, you know, I mean, it's such a broad community, and you have, you know, people who are religious or left-wing, right-wing, you know, Zionist, non-Zionist. I mean, so it is a very broad community in a way. People who think different things. And to be honest, the whole question of the Jews, I find it slightly irritating. I don't know why. I almost find the discussion of it, like, it's like, for example, even if from a white nationalist perspective you get involved in that kind of discussion, I don't know. It's somehow you're reinforcing it in a weird way.
Well, I think,
you know,
there
like
is
my attitude with it. To me, they're like Latvians. Obviously, they are more important than Latvians because Jewish people have, you know, contributed tremendously to you know, European civilization, Western civilization. They've done some naughty things, no doubt about it, as well. But like, I don't know. I don't like to really get too involved in it for some reason. I prefer to say that, you know, people say, "Oh, the Jews secretly run the world." Well, maybe, I don't know. But like, you know, I prefer to say Anglo-Saxons secretly run the world. And there's just a stronger case for that to be true as there is of this Jewish nonsense.
So, well, no one's going to try to destroy you if you say Anglo-Saxons rule the world. But if you say anything against Jews, there will be a very organized resistance that will try to destroy you. So you have every incentive not to say anything negative about Jews as a group.
I understand, and that obviously maybe that's partially why I don't like to discuss the topic. But
yeah, I mean, that's the thing, Richard, because my name is Goldstein, and I don't really think of myself as a Jewish person, but people will, through the kind of looking glass self, see me as a Jew. So it sort of gives me the past to speak about Jewish things. Like, if people accuse me of being an anti-Semite, it's sort of like they're just accusing me of being a self-hating Jew. So that's the strange thing about it. And for Luke,
well, but that doesn't
always
give you a free pass. I know Norman Finkelstein, he lost his job as a professor because of his work.
Yeah, that's the thing. But I feel like there is, there was that guy, Joshua Seidel, who wrote that article for Daily Forward.
Was that in the Forward.
Yeah, and he was like, I'm a Jew.
He identifies with Seidel, right?
Yeah. I mean, because this is the whole thing. This is the whole thing about Jews and conspiracies and all this kind of stuff is that, there's obviously different kinds of Jews, and Jews are like a diverse group of people. But exactly. there is a kind of perspective. I mean, and I'm not like a big fan of Jean-Paul Sartre, but he has this this book called Anti-Semite and Jew. And, I obviously side more on a sort of Kevin MacDonald view of things. But I also think Sartre is sort of right in that there is this kind of Jews of the mind perspective that people spend their entire non-Jewish people spend their whole existence thinking about the Jews every minute. Jim Goad has a pretty good article about this for Tacky Mag.
I read two articles. They're brilliant.
Yeah, where he says, people, find the Jews in their sandwich.
Richard, do you think there's other groups that play like a major role? Like you mentioned, like the Anglo elites, but like also like the Saudi and the Arab Gulf elites.
I am Anglo-Saxon. Walston Croft is an Anglo-Saxon name. Basically that to me is a much more, I don't know, optimistic myth, to spread about. So whenever I can, we Anglo-Saxons run the world, and essentially we do. America is a former British colony. Obviously if this Trump thing doesn't work out, we can get the Queen back in charge. Everything will be fine. Theresa May will take over America. And Tom Cleese released a kind of joke, kind of thing about that. One of the interesting things, though, in relation to the Jewish question or whatever you want to call it, I've been reading the Black Notebooks by Martin Heidegger, which were his confidential kind of notebooks he kept during the Nazi era. And there he talks about Jewishness from a meta perspective. One of his more infamous claims is that the Jews killed themselves in World War II, essentially through this lovely German word, I can't pronounce it, but basically means self-destruction. And when you look at what was going on with the globalists recently, the way they were saber-rattling at Russia, I definitely felt there was a correlation between kind of self-destruction within the globalist agenda itself. That, if, for example, Hillary had won and was able to continue on down that road, that there was a desire for
it would be death for them. It would be death for them.
That's the premise of your article, why the globalist elite should support Trump, because they keep pushing, same with the migrant crisis, which you mentioned earlier, that was just such a big catastrophic event that it was it was blowback against them.
Yeah, for example, this whole thing with Soros and all these Syrian immigrants that are coming, and obviously people from all over the Middle East that are rushing into Europe. I mean, if anything, that situation is making the far right attain power in Europe. And the worse it gets, the more to the far right European governments are going to be. You know what I mean? You see the situation in Sweden, it's terrible. But basically, that migrant situation is creating the far right. Obviously, if it didn't happen, it wouldn't be happening. So it's kind of very odd, the situation.
Yeah.
If you think Soros is doing it, does Soros want a Nazi Europe again? I mean, it's very strange.
Well, and, apparently he was a Nazi collaborator, so he...
he's a very confusing and dangerous fellow.
I've heard that the Soros strategy is to create these sort of multicultural tensions in order to stop fascism from developing, which is odd because you end up getting this dialectic between the multicultural fascism of there is some kind of credence to Jonah Goldberg liberal fascism in that the PC police sort of walk around and if you say anything against their ideology, you'll get fired, etc. And then there is kind of the reaction to that, which is a more kind of classical fascism or, something that's a little bit more what we're used to seeing. It's sort of like authoritarianism versus totalitarianism. And I've heard that what George Soros wants to do is to have, from people that are theorizing or whatever, he wants to have that conflict occur in European countries so that nothing can rise, there can't be this kind of great British ruler that starts to conquer Western Europe, you know, whatever.
Towards the end of the show, before I wrap things up, Luke, do you want to add anything else to the conversation?
Yeah, I think it's just easier to view the world objectively, that there are no good guys or bad guys. There are just different groups with different interests, and the interests of Jews are different from the interests of Anglo-Saxon, which are different from the interests of Catholics and of Blacks and of Latinos and of Asians. And we're all, you know, competing for scarce resources. We're all, you know, perpetually in various forms of conflict, and sometimes we find it in our group interest to ally with another group, but there are no permanent allies and there are no permanent enemies. We're just all competing, you know, doing the best we can. And, you know, when you look at it from that perspective, just as when you look at, you know, the world of nature, there are invasive species in the world of nature, so that when Australia, for instance, imported rabbits, they just went crazy and they did vast harm to natural species, you know, people in the natural habitat, not people, but, you know, forms of life. So when you introduce an alien species into your own habitat, it can have, you know, devastating effects, which can then, you know, turn things in completely unpredictable directions. So I think, you know, human life, you know, very much resembles the natural world.
I do agree with that. And I think there's a lot to be learned from that basic, I guess, worldview. And obviously, I am sympathetic to some extent.
We are at the end of the show. I'd like to thank Luke Ford, Richard Wollstonecroft, and Alex von Goldstein for being on.
Thanks, guys. It's definitely been a really interesting show.
Thanks, guys.